welcome to Islamic Issues with your host, Vlad Tepes. Hey, Vlad, how are you tonight?
Well, medium. I'm medium. How are you?
Doing very well.
Oh, good.
Yep, can hear you fine.
Brilliant. Yes, it's been quite a week, hasn't it? It's been quite a week. How would you assess the difference between now and this time last year? I'm putting you on the spot. I'm sorry about that. But I'd like to know, what's your opinion? How has the global situation changed? And more, really what I'm after is, how are people viewing this thing now versus last year? What's the new normal? How has the baseline shifted, do you think?
I think that, a year ago, let's just say on a personal note, I was in a much better mood. I think this year, however, in light of what's been going on, of course, referring to the Islamic State, that people, the sleeping masses, it's awakening a bit, and people are out there wanting to take the narrative back from Islam. What do you think, Vlad?
Well, I think that's one vector of the answer to that question. That's one vector, and it's true. It's an accurate observation. But and I also think the baseline shifted in a weird way. Like, I'm looking at headlines in newspapers and finding that it's practically in Arabic. In other words, I shouldn't say Arabic's not the right term, but the concept, like there was a Daily Mail headline that caught my attention that said, you know, jihadis and beheading in the same headline. And I'm just thinking, like, a few years ago, it would just look completely alien and freakish to see these terms in a major British newspaper. I mean, the new normal is what's concerning me. Like, the idea that the word beheading is... It's in common parlance, right? Like, no matter what happens, our basic frames of reference are being shifted by these savages. Like, we are having to deal. Like, I mean, I guess unless you completely have your head in the sand and you're not following the news whatsoever. I mean, when you're as deep into this stuff as we are, it's difficult to know. And that's why I'm asking these questions. I'm wondering if anybody even knows anybody that doesn't follow any of this and is unaware. Let me give you an example. I mean, I try to always wear something with that symbol, the symbol of the Nazarene, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know that? It's the Arabic letter N, which looks like a U with a dot over it. And it's become the symbol of standing in solidarity with all those people. I mean, it's specifically Christians, but you know, for me at least, it means anyone who is being ethnically cleansed or genocides being committed against them by Muslims. It is, you know, it's and what's interesting is the number of people that recognize it or know what it is or ask about it. Some people say, I've seen that. Oh, good. It sounds to me like you have files there. Brilliant. Maybe we can.
Actually, no. It was refused because they're in MP4 format and not MP3.
Oh, I can fix that for you during a break. Sorry. So, but in any case, so how many people know, you know, how many people recognize it? And it's more and more. So there's quite a few people, like I get dirty looks from Muslims who look like they want to run me over. And then I get the odd person, like I get actually people coming over and shaking my hand that are Arab Christians or Arab non-Muslims, or even the odd Muslim, I suspect, from that part of the world that wants no part of these atrocities. And you know what I mean? And I'm getting that there's generally a much greater awareness. So I think that this Islamic State business really, really has changed the baseline of what we're aware of, you know, and here in Canada. I'm sure probably true in the States. I'm hoping there's some people in the chat room that may have their own experiences with their own friends or their own professional circles or people in the office. Like, what is it that people, how has, I mean, I'm very interested in how the baseline of the culture shifted in the last year, because it's amazing to me how fast we get used to something, right? Like, what becomes normal? Like, you think about things like, you think about that headline about the girls in Rotherham. Well,
oh yeah,
there was a tiny bit of an uptick in the news about it. I mean, not what it should have been, but imagine if that was discovered in the 1990s or 1980s. It would have been, or if it was the 70s, it would have been the subject for close to a year. There would have been investigation after investigation. There'd be whole parliamentary, special parliamentary committees on this thing, and there'd be inquisitions might be the wrong word, but you know what I mean. It would be a big deal, and it would go on. It'd be like, because it eclipses Watergate, which is really by the standards of this administration, Watergate was nothing. So what we've become used to. It's really startling. And now, of course, I forget which other town it is. I read there's a headline today or yesterday. There's another British town which has way more victims than Rotherham. It's not even making any ripples. Because giant numbers of early teenage children, British children, being turned into sex slaves by probably mostly illegal Muslims who want to destroy our civilization, that's barely, it doesn't really make much of a ripple. Oh, like another day, another week, another British town, which turns out to have had a measurable fraction of its teenage girls being forced into, I'm not going to say prostitution, because prostitution, the girls, it implies consent and it implies that the girls get money. I mean, they're being forced into a harem where they're being pimped out to other Muslims. I mean, it's just unbelievable, yeah. Right? So how did we get so blasé? I guess because it's happening as slowly as needs be to get us to this point, right? So that's certainly something, like, I think it's something that's worth kind of keeping in the back of our collective minds as to, like, where is this cult, where are these events taking us? I mean, how has the culture shifted so that we're accepting things that we should never have accepted? Like, if we look at the other side of the totalitarian coin, which is our own governments reacting to it, or at least alleging to react to this stuff in order to make it safer, and spying on every single one of us in every conceivable manner, except for them, except for the Muslims, right? Like, you're seeing...
They successfully find a way to ensure that CCTV cameras in the UK are not set up outside their mosques.
Is that a fact? I did not know that. So they're spying on everywhere except for where the actual terrorists are and so on. Mind you, despite that, they seem to be arresting quite a few of them. Four more were rounded up today that are accused of an imminent terror plot.
Oh, yeah, the beheading plot. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. And you know what? This may sound like a small thing. Maybe it is a small thing, actually. But part of me is trying to decide if it's better to tilt that back to the word decapitation. That's our word. Like, beheading is your classic Arabic Islamic thing. They're beheaded them. It's like from Arabian Nights. I mean, decapitation is what we used to call that. And again, like, we're shifting our frame of in other words, even if we win, we lose because we're adopting that frame of reference and we're accepting it as normal. But anyway, yeah, they were planning to decapitate another British subject, I guess. And I'm sure eventually they will. I mean, there's just too many of them. They're not going to be able to. And again, they're going to have to, like, they're having to spy on so many people. I just think the answer to all this is to give people back the freedom to discriminate. Like, the answer to this really is, The government should restrict itself to things government should do, and it should let us recognize the problem and go into mosques, and it should say, well, these mosques are breaking the law. Look, let's talk about the Oklahoma guy. I don't think, had that happened last week, the Robert Spencer story with the, no, I don't think it had. I think that's happened. Yes, it was definitely this week and the last few days. Okay, let's just visit that for a second. A fellow does a decapitation with a knife of some woman, I think it was, at some business place of business in Oklahoma. There was claims made by, I think, the American government and that this mosque or whatever, that there was no connection between him and the Islamic community, and there was no connection between Islamic teachings and his actions. A fellow who's being identified as Noor on various talk shows. First of all, he approached Robert Spencer, this fellow, and he presented evidence to Mr. Spencer that he, in fact, was an Inner Circle member of this mosque back in 2001 to 2003 or 2004. And I've seen this evidence myself, by the way, and I know that it's good, right? So I'd just like to make that clear from the outset that I'm not just repeating stuff. Excuse me, I'm not just repeating stuff from what I've read, but I actually have firsthand evidence that this is legitimate. Then Mr. Spencer interviewed him directly, and for various technical reasons, that wasn't able to get out till shortly after the Fox interview with Megyn Kelly. And then one of the clips I tried to send you, and I think I'll pull the audio out of it, and I will resend you it as an MP3. But then today, both Robert Spencer and Noor, although the Arabic name is silly, the fellow was is a white American who before 9/11 was intrigued by Islam and converted and became very involved with the mosque. And then as he became more aware of what they taught and what Islam really was, became more and more concerned until he left it. And as I understand it, would occasionally return to that mosque to assist with various investigations by local law enforcement. So the point of this is that it's been very clearly established by absolutely reasonable litmus tests that the Oklahoma mosque that this gentleman went to, who did the decapitation of this woman at her workplace, absolutely taught that certainly you strike at the neck of the infidel if they don't, like, you give them three choices: to convert, to become a dhimmi, the classic Islamic thing, right? The three choices that Mohammed would give entire nations that he'd attack, which is convert, pay the jizya and feel yourself subdued, or war, to be attacked, to be killed. And so this
now,
mosque
this is
definitely
this mosque in this
yes.
mosque in Oklahoma. Yeah. Why did Barack Hussein Obama send an envoy to personally thank this mosque for all their hard works in light of a hurricane that happened a year ago? Oh, could it be because the person that decapitated that lady in the workplace came from that mosque and they were getting such blowback? Obama felt that there was something that he had to do in order to make them feel better about themselves or whatever. President is unbelievable. His message was, your service is a powerful example of the powerful roots of the Arahamic. I'm sorry, Vlad. I can't get over this. Arahamic faith and how our communities can come together with shared peace, with dignity and a sense of justice. Now, if you can make sense of that.
Well, you can if you look at the greater context of what Obama does. I mean, you have to ask yourself why the White House didn't send a single representative or even acknowledge the murder of an American general who was killed in Afghanistan. There was nobody from the White House at that funeral. But, I mean, you look at the Obama presence at the Bergdahl exchange, who was clearly a traitor, right? By the way, I should mention that one of the stories that's been circulating the Internet that is not true is that those four or five people who were released from Gitmo in exchange for the traitor Bergdahl, our ISIS leaders. That if you look that up on Snow, like I've tracked that story back to a satire website, but it's not a very good satire. Like, it's one of those satire websites where it's so close to what's true that, like, how could you possibly know that it's supposed to be funny? It's not like, I mean, The Onion is great. You go to The Onion, you know it's supposed to be funny because it is. If you go to Snopes.com, covers that particular thing, and Snopes says it isn't true, and I find them to be very, very reliable. Now, it is possible that those people who were released from Gitmo could in fact be ISIS leaders, but there's no evidence that they are. Like, there's no excuse for that story because there's simply no evidence that it's true. So at least there's some tiny, there's a tiny relief in that horrific story is not true, as far as at least there's no evidence that there's any truth to that at all. But, yeah, if you look at Obama's actions, There's certainly, yeah, the Oklahoma Mosque sent, like the fact that he reached out to them. You know that that mosque is inextricably linked to the Boston Mosque where the two jihadis that blew up the Boston Marathon went to.
Mm-hmm.
Like the imam at that was actually started out at the Oklahoma Mosque, and then he went to Al-Azhar, I believe. This is all in the Spencer interview. If you go to, I could probably give you a direct link to a copy of that. Of that video, that interview, but yes, it is amazing that clearly Obama has it that he feels it's his personal duty to defend the image of Islam above and while at the same time denigrating the image of the United States of America, right? Like,
mm-hmm.
How is it that town of Kurds could be taken by ISIS despite U.S. Military capabilities. Like, I don't, you know, I'm hoping that somebody who's in the military is listening is ready to call in and write in about this. But really, the United States has the power to project force in a way that none of us can imagine. They have, like, any kind of weapon you can imagine, they've got, right? Like, I posted a really interesting video to my site at Black Tapas Blog Day. It's near the top, actually. It's a video about an arms bazaar in France, and it's the Israeli booth, and it's showing Israeli military technology that they're selling to friendly nations. So you can imagine what technology they have that they're not selling, right? But even if you just watch this without even thinking in terms of what they may be holding back on. When you look at these different companies, the equipment they have, the capabilities that the Israelis have. I mean, the Americans have to at least be able to. Well, mind you, Obama's been slashing the military budget to the bone for some time, including the personnel. I think he's down by 90,000 soldiers or something. But still, you tell me the United States government can't defend one town of Kurds against a bunch of, like, yes, these are people who are now experienced soldiers and they're capable fighters, I guess. But I'm still pretty sure that the United States can isolate a target and then take out that target remotely from the comfort of their own living rooms, you know, for that matter. There's probably like a bunker somewhere near D.C. where hundreds of guys are working game consoles, essentially, that can fire missiles from a carrier nearby and have them take out these individual jihadis. Why isn't that happening? Now, as I understand it, I stand to be corrected, but I believe Obama said he was going to personally okay these targets. Well, if that's the case, how is it that town of a fairly big town, like a small city of Kurds, has now been overrun by Islamic State fighters, despite American and allied ability to project force? It's just completely counterintuitive. It does not make sense. And it also seems to me that most of these strikes are taking place at a time when there's nobody at these locations. It almost seems like they're tailored to not be effective, that it's like Obama's doing it to buckle under pressure to make it look like he's doing something, but really isn't. Like, I'm stammering a lot and having difficulty saying these things only because during the 8 years of Bush's administration, I listened to the most insane, ludicrous accusations and suggestions about Bush's motives. And then, you know, I looked into them and found that they were, in fact, nonsense, that they were lies, and that they were, you know, Bush, whether you agreed with his decisions or not, or whether you liked him or not, or whether he was not evil. You know, he wasn't making outrageous lies. He didn't lie about the WMDs. In fact, it turns out that not only were the WMDs real, but now ISIS has them. But even had they not been real, Bush hadn't lied about their existence. He may have been misinformed, since the intelligence services of three or four major Western nations all said they existed. And further, if you go a few years back, by the way, and this is something that for some reason doesn't get widely reported, but if you go a few years back before that second Iraq conflict, Saddam had been trying to make nuclear weapons using a very antique device called a Calutron. It was named after Caltech.
Yes.
Are you familiar with that?
Yeah.
With that? Yeah. So it's for anybody who's not familiar, a Calutron, it's like the size of like a bachelor apartment. It's like, and what they do is they
exactly.
they inside is a very primitive way of kind of separating out the U-238 from the U-235 so that they can scrape off the walls in very, very tiny amounts over the course of, you know, years, using hundreds of these calutrons, can eventually build a uranium-type nuclear weapon. Well, no one knew, like everybody was looking for centrifuges or more modern ways of making nuclear bombs. It's just they figured Saddam had, and they couldn't find him. It's because no one thought that he would use these calutrons because they were so old and such a bad way to do it. In fact, that's the way they made the first nuclear weapon ever made in the United States, was with these calutrons, named after Caltech, where the nuclear weapon was invented. So they eventually did find that he'd been using these calutrons, and they found them, and the United Nations ordered a strike on them, and so there was a multi-nation airstrike that took out all of Saddam's calutrons. So we know he was in pursuit of WMD. So it's just, there was no doubt about that. But the point is that there was all these horrific and nonsensical accusations about Bush. And so now I find myself talking about Obama and thinking about Obama in the way that the psychos and the crazies used to talk about Bush. And the problem I have is I keep thinking, but, you know, am I just being some kind of partisan idiot, like some essentially a kind of sports fan for the Republicans, and, you know, all saying this stuff about sucked into the classic partisan politics, which is, you know, the kind of, again, like it's a kind of a sports fan loyalty. Nothing against sports or sports fans, but I think it has no place in politics. In politics, you want to actually assert reason and evidence, and then figure out the best candidate for your for whatever it is your set of values is, no matter what party that person stands for. Well, here's the problem with all that. I don't think that's any longer true. I think the divide between the Democrats and the Republicans has gotten huge. Like, if you look back at JFK, in the days of JFK, there was virtually no difference between the Democrats and Republicans other than how they both believed in the same set of principles in the Constitution and constitutional governance and how the government should operate. They just differed on details, like how they should, what method should they use to achieve those same ends. And now the ends are different. Now they don't even believe in the same set of principles. And clearly, Americans should be asking themselves, the Bill of Rights, like what amendments are left? Like, which amendments are still being observed? I mean, certainly the First Amendment is very, very questionable. You say, if you say bad things about Islam, there's a good chance you'll find yourself in jail for some weird little charge like that filmmaker did.
Well, yeah. The filmmaker and people like Dr. Terry Jones, who's also a pastor out of Florida. A lot of people think that his method of sending a message to Islam was to burn 2,998 Korans. And in 2013, he was on his way. He was safely transporting gasoline in the back of the truck, as defined by Florida state law. But they found a way around that to still fine him and prevent what he wanted to do. Now, maybe a lot of people do not agree with his methodology, but all the same, that's not the point. The point is that he was all the same trumped up.
You're absolutely right, and he's planning to do it again, according to his emails. Or did he? I know that that happened about a year ago.
A year ago he was halted from doing so, but this year he was successful.
Oh, that's good to know. I mean, personally, I would prefer that people read that damn book. I think the more people that read Quran, it's amazing how many. The term liberal is a loaded term these days, but I mean liberal in a good way. Like, I mean people who believe basically a kind of soft libertarian, you know, like a nice libertarian. It's amazing how many of them, when they read the Quran, quite often they come around to the facts that this isn't a very good book and it's not a very good ideology. You notice, of course, that when Muslims try to defend actions done by Muslims in the name of Islam, they only ever quote that one line from Quran without ever giving it any context. The one line about if they save a person, it's like they save the world, and if they kill a person, it's like they kill the world.
Yeah, Oh, that one just makes me so tired, that old chestnut. And they refuse to carry forth with it and talk about the other verse that accompanies that chapter, and that this only applies to Muslims. If you kill an infidel, you're fine.
Yes, exactly. And it's very clear. The Quran's very clear in the lines right before and right after that one. Have we got a caller on the line?
We sure do. We have Michael Green on the line.
Outstanding.
Would you like me to bring him in?
That would be terrific.
All right. There you go. Hi, Michael.
Hello.
Oh, hi. Is this Michael?
No, this is Eve. You've got somebody else here.
Oh, Don. Is that Don?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, you bet. But go grab Michael there. He's probably on another line there. I'll wait. That's no problem. Or I'll hang up and call back. Like, how many lines do you have there?
I think we can handle
nope,
two.
Nope, you're it right now.
Okay,
go
so
right
there is
ahead.
Where's Michael?
I thought it was Michael. It's not.
Okay, we're okay now. How are you doing, Don?
Not too bad. Not too bad. And you guys?
Good. Have you been listening to the show so far?
I have, yeah, I have.
So what's your opinion? What do you think has been the baseline shift in the general way, in the change of thinking in the last year or so? Could be longer than a year, but I think the last year, there's been a bit of a steeper spike in terms of the graph of changing public consciousness over this.
It's kind of hard to gauge. I mean, I think we're looking at a definite shift in public perception. I would say more people are becoming aware of the excesses of Islam and the Muslim, and certainly that's a result of what's happened in the Middle East with ISIS. But there also seems to be almost an attempt by the leftist liberal media as well as politicians like Obama to almost, I mean, in Obama's case, it's a sort of a continuation of the same old song that he's been playing, you know, for the last 8 years. I mean, as he said at that UN meeting where he stood up in front of the world and he said, the future does not belong to those who slandered the Prophet of Islam or to those who slander Islam. I mean, that was a very clear, unequivocal statement of exactly where his political sentiments lay with respect to the Muslim and Islam. That said, there seems lately, in the shadow of what's happening in the Middle East with ISIS, there seems to be an attempt by government and certainly by the leftist liberal media to keep a cap on to engage in damage control. For example, we recently had, in Calgary, we had Saeed Saharwardi. Now, you know, if memory serves people who are listening correctly, this is a very, I don't want to get into personal invective, but this is a vicious little man. He's a Pakistani imam. He claims direct ties to Muhammad himself. And he was the one that was responsible for dragging Ezra Levant into court over a cartoon. Now, that's essentially where his sentiments lie. That's the core. That's what defines this man. And he gets involved in all kinds of little contortions and little con games and little shuck and jive Philadelphia two-step games to avert people's gaze and attention away from what he really is, what he truly believes in, and what he represents. So moving past that for a minute, going to the attempt by liberal leftist media to whitewash Islam in North America and what it intends, what its intent is, where it's been going. We have, for example, recently we had Saharwardi was invited by the, I believe it was a St. Thomas United Church or Anglican Church in Calgary to speak to, I think there was probably 30 or 40 people there who were quite concerned about ISIS and the jihadi farm team that Alberta had become. And this pastor ended up inviting somebody who at his very core believes in Surah 929, believes very stridently in smiting the necks of the unbelievers, in not taking the unbelievers for friends. And yet, for some reason, they don't question the integrity or the veracity of these people and what they espouse publicly. They don't look between the lines. They simply grab these people and throw them up as apologists for Islamic murder and terrorism. And so that's what we had in the St. Thomas Church. It was actually covered by, I think it was covered by CBC and CTV. So that really doesn't come as a surprise, because he's been trying for years, ever since, getting that massive slap in the face that Ezra Levant gave him. He's been trying for years to bury that as deeply as he can. Unfortunately, public consciousness is allowing him to do that. But there was another case just recently of Mi Zheng Li, who was a reporter for Global CTV in Vancouver. And there was a Pakistani family, I forget what his name is. I'm just going to send you a link to the story. It was a Pakistani family in Vancouver who had been denied an American Nexus Pass at the borders. Now, essentially, a Nexus Pass means that you are given sort of fast lane preferential treatment. And through Freedom of Information, they gained access to documents that said that because these people are Pakistani, they are denied a Nexus Pass. And so CTV and Mi Zheng Li, instead of doing a balanced story on why Pakistanis are being denied Nexus Passes, the absolute mind-numbing number of connections, overt, public, documented, going back a dozen years plus, of Pakistan to terrorism, to harboring terrorists. I mean, that's where Obama was. That's where they found us. He was living not 2 or 3 miles from a Pakistani military academy, and had been there for years. So the connection between Pakistan and some of the more virulent Islam or Muslim behavior is very clear. And so the United States government, or ISIS and Canadian Border Services, quite rightfully used common sense and denied this family a border crossing pass. So CTV went out there and they did a story on it, and they got a soundbite from a leftist lawyer who resides he's actually a citizen. He holds citizenship in Britain, Canada, and the United States. I imagine, for whatever reason, becomes persona non grata in one country, then he's a citizen in another country. But he's an immigration lawyer, and he was standing there at the Blaine crossing and essentially said to Mi Zheng Li that the denial of a Nexus Pass to this Pakistani family was just an act of racism. And no attempt by the media to provide a balanced story on this. Now, this particular family, it was actually hilarious, because this particular family, the young gentleman in question, was visiting a family across the border, full bearded, full on, page, cover to cover, believes in the Quran, a young Pakistani gentleman, his wife dressed in a hijab. A niqab, from head to toe with just the eye slit. And yet these people are standing here and they're making apologies for this kind of madness. So you see, in the last year, you see the emergence of ISIS, you see the absolute shock that it has had on the Western world, but you see programs of damage control. Obama, with respect to what he was doing in Oklahoma, it's inexplicable. It's beyond my range of comprehension. And that, I don't want to be too abstract in my commentary, but this goes back to what we were talking about a couple of weeks ago with vigilantism. Then the conversation we were having related to vigilantism in Canada as a natural sort of result of the abandonment of mainstream population by judiciary, bureaucracy and law enforcement in the face of jihadi farm teams, acts of terrorism, mosques espousing violence, Hamas demonstrations getting violent, the incoherence and illiteracy of police services with respect to Islam. That gives rise, or potentially could give rise, to vigilantism. That very same sentiment can be found in the United States. When you have a president who stands in front of the world and says the future does not belong to those who slander Islam, when you have that same president who orders the sanitation and the whitewashing of all training manuals within the FBI, the CIA, the intelligence infrastructure, to the point where they can't even speak the name Islam, jihadi, terrorism in the same breath, when you have that same president who has lined the halls of power in the White House, Mohammed El-Abiyari, directly connected to the Muslim Brotherhood. Uma Abedin, then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, directly tied to the Muslim Brotherhood. When you take a look at Obama's classification of the massacre in Fort Hood as workplace violence, what of all of that, you can consider all of that nothing more than the diligent cultivation of a field that will grow vigilantes. It's as simple as that, because Americans and Canadians and certainly Europeans are looking around them and they're saying, you know, this is absolutely off the chart. This is ridiculous. And
no, I want to make a tiny, tiny, everything, I'm right with you. Tiny little thing is that I think that what you're describing should breed vigilantism. Now, that's an odd correction. So I just want to take a few seconds and explain it. In a rational universe, everything you said would be totally exactly correct and therefore should breed vigilantism, because vigilantism in that case would be the natural course to actual law and justice and law and order and justice and the preservation of the principles of Western civilization and the Enlightenment and Canadian law and American law, for that matter, American constitutional law. What you said is true, except you said will breed, and I'm saying should breed vigilantism, because I think it may not, because it's been, our culture is also being perverted by Frankfurt School leftism.
Oh, I mean, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. It's not splitting hairs, because you're right, should and will. But when you take a look at, you go down through the pages of history and you take a look at, for example, and I'll just point to the American Revolution. Those were vigilantes, every one of them. George Washington, Adams, these were all vigilantes. These were all terrorists.
The original Tea Party, the Boston Tea Party were vigilantes. Where are the fathers or uncles or brothers and even possibly mothers of the girls from these towns that discover that their prepubescent or early teenage daughters have been forced into the most horrible, unimaginable kind of harem? All of us, you know, if you talk to people, let's say that you even talk to the most determined leftist, right? But you don't tell them who's doing what. You just say, you know, hypothetically, if someone did this to your daughter, you let them think it was Republicans that did it, they would all say, well, I'd march down to their clubhouse and I would set it alight and I'd raise it to the ground, right? Everybody say, like, we've all had that. I hear people all the time, almost daily, if I present scenarios to people as hypotheticals, which are in fact actually taking place. Okay, forgive me, but forgive me, Americans who are listening. I mean this in the nicest possible way, but I hear Americans who look at European news all the time and say, oh, that's never going to happen here, because if it happens here, you know, we're going to do this and we're going to do that. No, you won't, because yes, it is. It is happening there, and no, you won't do it. You'll do just what the Europeans are doing, which is nothing. And it's shocking to me how the fact that people have gotten used to not having any freedom, and that they're weighing their risk benefit in these odd ways. So that,
well, you're seeing the dividends of the Frankfurt School of Business. I mean, very clearly. I mean, and then this is you know what we're dealing. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you there, but we're now reaping the harvest. We're now reaping what we've sown. Our ignorance of leftist liberalism, political correctness, and the tenets of the Frankfurt School of Business are now coming home to roost, because people, and you make an excellent point, if you take a look at the 14, I mean, just think about this for a minute, and I mean, it defies, I start to stumble over my words, because I become not enraged, but livid to a certain point, but just almost speechless with an incomprehensible fury that rises from the example that I'm about to provide. You've got 1,400 girls in Rotherham, England, and there is now a case emerging now in an adjacent town, I believe, or an adjacent borough, that they are thinking rivals and exceeds by almost 100% the victims in the Rotherham molestation cases. Now, here you have, and I just want to kind of define this just briefly, here you have 1,400 girls. You have 1,400 girls. Some of their body parts were nailed to tables. Some of these young girls were servicing 20, 30, 40 grunting, drooling Muslim men every single night. This was going on for years. Now, we've not seen one significant backlash against this. We've seen politicians wringing their hands in apology.
Have we seen that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean,
There's
crimes of omission, there's crimes of commission. I mean, if you're not coming out and absolutely outraged, then essentially you're standing in the wings providing tacit approval for it. It's as simple as that. And it goes to the good German. It goes to the good German who sat in gas houses and drank steins of beer and noshed on bratwurst as trains rolled behind them filled with humanity on their one-way trip to the camps. It's as simple as that. And I'm not trying to connect the Holocaust to what happened in Rotherham, but I'm making a connection of human nature. So when you see the silence, that is, as far as I'm concerned, when you see the silence from the clergy, when you see the silence from the media, and not the targeting of these people constantly, that is tacit approval of those crimes. It's as simple as that. That's exactly what it is. But the point that I was going to make is that of those 1,400 children, you would think that for the most part, each one of those little girls has a mother and father, has brothers, uncles, grandfathers. So let's multiply 1,400 by 2. You go 2,800. Let's throw in a few relatives for, let's say, 4,000 people. Was there a demonstration of 4,000 people in Rotherham? Were there 4,000 outraged parents whose little girls had absolutely been destroyed? Were there 4,000 people rallying around the city hall? No, absolutely not. And so it's maddening when you see things like that. And you wonder at what point, is it a powder keg? Will it go off at some point? Or are we just going to go, you know, as the poet said, are we just going to go gently into that good night?
I think so. Because I've had numerous conversations with... Now I have to make a decision. Do I name the person and then be careful what I quote, or do I quote whatever I want and not name the person? Let's say that I've had numerous conversations with a lawyer in the UK whose particular field of law is basically zoning and property law, which you'd think is fairly dull and you would think is irrelevant, but he pointed out to me that his practice has basically become entirely the practice of people who are living in areas where Muslims have made them unlivable, and so they're selling their property and are looking for a place which is free of Muslims and where they can the zoning laws would allow them to basically build a bunker, and you know, so that they can hunker down and get ready for what's coming. I mean, in fact, it was not just one or two kooks. His practice has basically become that. So what you're seeing in England is a kind of white flight in extremis, right? Like you're seeing people who are recognizing that their own government has an actual policy of eradication of their people, their culture, their history, their way of life, their values. And they know there's no point. It's like, you know, I think I've made this joke before, if not on this show, and it's not really much of a joke, but I've certainly made it talking to people just to watch the look of complete non-comprehension on their faces. But in a way, I kind of blame Mary Shelley for this. You know, Mary Shelley, she was the poet Shelley's wife, and she wrote that goddamn book, Frankenstein. And the reason I blame her is because she had it exactly backwards. When that mob rose up and went to the castle where a monster who had been made from parts of dead people and a scientist who made that with completely hiding it from the locals in every possible way, they should have burned that castle down and killed that monster, and then they should have all gone out for a drink and patted each other on the back for a good night's work. And Mary Shelley made the village out to be the bad guy and the monster out to be the good guy. You know, now when I think about it now, and I'm looking at what's going on in the world, I'm going, Mary Shelley, this is your fault. Because everybody's afraid of the pitchforks and the torches, and that's what they should be doing.
Well, you know, you bring up white flight. If you take a look at what's happened in London, you're not talking about 15 or 20 people that have moved as a result of essentially what amounts to ethnic cleansing. Now, most people, when they hear that used in the context of white Western Anglo-Saxon Protestants, they laugh, and that's and that laughter, that very wrong, visceral Pavlovian reaction that people have to use of words like ethnic cleansing in reference to white people is a result. That's another dividend of the Frankfurt School of Business. But all you have to do is go to Google and enter white flight London as your search words, white flight London, and you will come up with immediately two pages. I'm just looking at it right now here. Articles in the Daily Mail, articles on BBC. No, here's a hilarious one. BBC News, I mean, as leftist, as liberal, as conniving, as social engineering as you can possibly get in the UK. And what they've got an article, Why Have White British Left London? You know, palm the forehead. I mean, are you really serious? Maclean's is an article, White Flight Hits London. What's the truth behind white flight? But here's the numbers. 620,000 people have left London. Not 50, not 1,000, not 50,000, not 150,000, 620,000 people. That, in effect, is like the city of Edmonton packing their bags and everybody moving to Calgary.
And you have to ask yourself how many more would do it if they were able to. Like if there was some machine.
Actually, an excellent point, Vlad. And that's so true. How many more in London would have left? How many millions more would have left? And this is a fly in the ointment that's the size of the albatross that the leftists and the liberals and the media stumble over. They cover it over. They trot out a few polls and some numbers, etc. And it's the elephant in the room that nobody wants to talk about. But if you want ethnic cleansing, there's ethnic cleansing. Now, what do you think is going to happen? That's the beginning. That's the tip of the iceberg. But what do you think is going to happen when the Muslims get Sharia law, when the good Muslims suddenly have the balance of power? What do you think is going to happen to that million people left behind who can't move? What do you think their lives are going to be like? We're going to have essentially a British version of the Coptic Christians, which live at the leisure and the behest of their Muslim masters. And that's exactly what's coming down the pipe for Britain unless they change. But just on another point, maybe we're too close. What we need, certainly in North America, is, and when you take a look at the dynamics of what I'm about to refer to, maybe what we need in North America is another round of McCarthyism. Because, for its failings, for its flaws, you have essentially almost a mirror reflection of in most cases of what's happening in North America now with Islam and Muslims as what was happening with communism in the 1950s. You had a core group of leftist liberals in Hollywood, in the media, that had the ear of the people that were pleading the case of the communists. You had core groups of people within the United States whose stated goal was the overthrow of the American government, the destruction of the Constitution, and the installation of a communist power. And we went after these people with the FBI, with McCarthy, with Senator McCarthy, with the hearings. And in a way, we need that sense of urgency to rear its head again in North America. So we can take a look at mosques, when we can take a look at mosques in Scarborough, and we can have a military tribunal or a government tribunal. And, I mean, this is a mosque that provides funding for terrorists. This is a mosque that provides enthusiastic endorsement and funding of the little terrorist Omar Khadr.
Actually, it would be more interesting to find a mosque that doesn't.
Well, exactly. So we can have these tribunals in North America and certainly in Canada where we can have a, and I mean, we don't want to make it an obscene mockery of justice, such as the kind of obscenity that is so favored by the Saeed Saharwadis of the world, where you've got the human rights commissions. But we want something that's expedited. We want something that at the end of the day, if there is a conclusion that this mosque is, yes, definitely connected to terrorism, that the connections are palpable and overt, then that's it. The mosque comes down, the people are identified, the leaders of the mosque are imprisoned or stripped of citizenship and removed from Canada. It's as simple as that. We need to get that serious. But again, we go back to, and I think I mentioned this briefly, the folly faced by, or the folly of Napoleon and Hitler, and I hesitate to use, I use it as an example of military strategy, and I certainly don't endorse Hitler, but if you take a look at fighting a battle on more than one front, you're divided, your attention is divided, your resources are divided, etc. And so what we're looking at now is having to deal with the leftist liberal infrastructure in Canada. We're dealing with leftist liberal media. That's the battle that we fight on one front, and then we're fighting the Muslim and Islam on another front. And that's no small task.
Well, that's for sure. I mean, actually, the funny thing is I have more faith in the BBC than the CBC. I have a sneaking suspicion that the BBC is acting under some kind of directive. But what they actually think, what many of the principal people there actually think and what they do is commensurate with reality. I'm going to give you two examples of why I think that may be the case. One was this woman who worked at the BBC that called a taxi a few years ago and said it's for her daughter. She had a teenage daughter. She called a taxi for her daughter and said, no Muslim driver. Now, she actually got fired from the BBC for doing that. But she said, well, look, I'm talking about my own daughter here. I want a safe ride for her. I don't want a Muslim driver because I know what it means. So we're talking about someone at the BBC, in other words, has the real information. They have the stories. And she was sufficiently informed that she, by the way, I'd recommend to everybody that when you find cab drivers who are Christian, like specifically, not just that they have Christian paraphernalia in the car, because it could be a Muslim that's time sharing with a Christian. You find a guy who you know is Christian driver of your taxi, like a Lebanese Christian or Iraqi or whatever, you get his cell number and you should collect like three or four so that whenever you need a cab, you can call a Christian. And I'm telling you, that's good advice. And if we all do that, it would definitely be a tiny, tiny move in the right direction for this. Because I've had a few jihadi cab drivers. Anyway, back to the BBC. So she got fired from the BBC, but it means that people at the BBC are informed and do know, and that given a chance will act in self-interest based on reality. And the second thing was a great story from this summer. I think it was either in July or August, where the BBC held a big barbecue, outdoor barbecue. It was for BBC staff barbecue, but it was outside on a big square, outside the BBC Arabic window, and they had a full pig on the spit, like you could see.
I thought that was hilarious.
It was, and they where what they cooked and where they cooked it and under what circumstances tells me something that that's at least some people at the BBC that know things and that have so. But the CBC are true believers. If you talk to those guys, they are leftists. They want to see anything conservative destroyed. They have these town hall meetings, which they televise where they stack the deck. And I know this because I know people who've been to them who are knowledgeable about these issues and never get a chance. They call them town hall meetings, but they cherry pick who's going to get a chance to stand up from the audience and ask questions. Like the BBC, when the BBC does this, you actually do get the occasional intelligent person that does know what's going on and says things, right? Even if they stack the deck against them. But the CBC won't even allow that. There was one where they had a big town hall meeting a year or two ago, where they had a Muslim convert who calls himself Yahya something or other, and they had that woman who's the principal of the school, which teaches, I mean, when I say teaches anti-Semitism, that would not be an exaggeration, which had contests. They asked the little children to draw, you know, dead Israelis, like attacks on Israelis, and gave prizes. Anyway, both of these people are converts to Islam, and one of them works with the Ottawa police now, I believe. In any case, David Harris went to that, David Harris from Insignia Strategic Research, and they wanted to ask questions, and they would never pick him. They would never go near him because they knew that he would ask questions that would expose these people for their connections to jihadi and to Muslim Brotherhood and so on. So the CBC are considerably more problematic. Sorry, Don, go ahead.
Well, no, the outrageous part, I mean, you make some excellent points about CBC. The outrageous part about CBC is that they're taxpayer funded. If they had to sink or swim on their readership or their viewership alone, they would have died a long time ago. They would not have the billions of dollars in support. Whereas other television stations, they have to go it alone. So being taxpayer funded is not, it's sort of like getting a slap in the face and a kick in the testicles. I mean, you know, we could do without the kick in the testicles. I mean, if you want to be as leftist and as liberal, you know, as propagandizing as the CBC is, at least do it, but not on the taxpayer's dime. Or if you do support the CBC, then there should be a special allowance. Paycheck for supporting liberal leftism in the Frankfurt School of Business. I mean, just recently, as an example of the kind of lunacy that drips out of. I mean, they have, in some ways, I will tip a hat to the CBC in some ways. Like, for example, a temporary foreign worker scandal and issues that have risen their heads in Canada. And I'm not going to go off on a tangent here. That story was broken and pushed very, very hard by the CBC. I noticed that they have been using words like Islam, like Muslims, when referring to the emergence of ISIS in the Middle East and some of the jihadi farm teams in Canada. So there are cracks in sort of that socialist veneer that they've been polishing for years. One little incident here, the other day I was watching an interview with CBC, and it was Wendy Mesley, and she was talking to a panel of three leftists, and one of them came out. I mean, they were all, you know, sort of warmly mumbling and nodding in agreement. But this one guy, they were talking about Ebola and bringing these Ebola victims over to North America for treatment. And this one guy trotted out a line, something along, and I'm loosely quoting, something along the lines that exclusion of Ebola victims from North America was just racism. And it's just when you consider the potentially dire consequences of seeding various hospitals and various medical infrastructures within unnecessarily in North America with Ebola victims as a result of sort of a self-loathing political correctness. It absolutely boggles the mind. But it's in lockstep with their political sentiments with respect to Islam, with respect to any of the liberal leftist sort of pet peeves. That aside, I'll just move just very briefly to your comment about taxis. And we spoke about this just briefly on one of your other segments. There was an incident in Dawson Creek and Grand Prairie in Alberta in which a series of taxi companies, one is called, there's actually three or four of them. One is called Golden Taxi, and there's another one called On Time Taxi. And the majority, in fact, the vast, almost exclusively, the drivers for these taxi companies are Muslims. They're Somalians, East African Muslims, and they've had quite a number of incidents of the molestation and sexual assault of young female passengers in their taxis. And this hit the news, not in the manner that I would have liked to have seen it hit the news. It was, you know, sort of made an appearance and then was kind of hushed up. I sent you some links on a couple of shows ago. It was picked up by the RCMP, and there was an investigation, but the RCMP was sort of hush-hush and mum about this. There was not a lot made over it. I mean, if you take it in sort of a comparative context, if there were, let's say, for example, 14 clubhouses sprung up in Dawson Creek, British Columbia, and Grand Prairie, Alberta, that were dedicated to the Nazis or some other, you know, really unsavory group. Let's say the KKK or somebody like that, you know, a bunch of lunatics running around in bedsheets. You can bet that CBC would have been all over it. The RCMP would have been making daily, hourly statements by the minute, updates, et cetera, ad infinitum, ad nauseum. But this pattern of the sexual assault of female passengers by these Muslim taxi drivers in this area received very little airplay. The defense that a lot of people in these areas are making is simply by finding non-Muslim taxi drivers, getting cell phone numbers, and then just planning ahead. You know, and instead of calling at the last minute, as you normally can with a taxi company, planning a half an hour ahead. Just briefly, one of the problems that we're having, or that these jurisdictions are having with these taxi drivers, is these guys come and go. They're only attached to the area by a cell phone. There's no taxi stand. They've got a cell phone and a number. There's no business office, taxi stand. They move from town to town. They're very transient. There's questions as to the background checks that are being performed by these jurisdictions, by these towns like Dawson Creek and Grand Prairie. Are they checking Interpol? Many of these guys have only been boots on the ground in Canada for, you know, a year, year and a half, and they're already into taxi driver positions. So have these local towns made any attempt to contact their home countries to verify that there is, you know, that there is no criminal record? If they can verify that, at least, you know, due diligence and try. Have they been fingerprinted, photographed? Has there been a thorough background check done in Canada? I mean, these are all questions that are, for the most part, in the realm of speculation. But that's one of the problems that we're facing in Western Canada. So the solution, like you rightfully said, find a good taxi driver, get his telephone number, make plans in advance and phone them, and stay as far away from the Muslim taxi drivers as you possibly can.
You win on several levels. I mean, not only are you safer, but you're supporting the victims of a genocide. You know, another thing, too, is I haven't received them yet, but I ordered from Frank Gaffney's organization, Center for Security Policy, five of those little buttons that they're selling, which have the little Arabic "you want it." I'm thinking, there's sort of a folk legend, an urban legend about how the Danish king, when the Nazis said the Jews all had to wear yellow stars, that the Danish king decided to wear a star himself and suggested that the general population did, so the Nazis couldn't tell the difference between the Jews and the non-Jews in Denmark. I mean, it just didn't happen. It didn't happen, but it's a beautiful story. And the fact that it didn't happen shouldn't take away from the fact that Denmark did more than any other Scandinavian nation to protect its Jewish citizens from the Holocaust and from Nazi oppression. The Danish were, unlike the Norwegians, who then as now are basically Nazis, right? I'm sorry, but I mean, I'm not saying every one of them. I love Fjordman and respect him. He's a friend of mine, and he's, you know, there's so many great Norwegians. But overall, as a culture, you can look at what it's doing to its Jewish population and how it's encouraging Islamic anti-Semitism and what it does, what its foreign policy is to Israel, for instance. Same with Sweden. In any case, the point I'm trying to make is that although that story about everybody wearing that star is untrue, wouldn't it be great if it was true? And we have a chance to make it true. We have a chance by wearing that symbol. I mean, you don't have to go to, if you go to Center for Security Policy .org. They have those buttons for sale, and they're supposed to be beautiful, like really nice looking. And the price is weird. It's like, I think it's like $8 for one and $35 for five of them and whatever. I mean, if you can afford to get five or ten and give out some to people who you think really will wear it, or just get yourself one, or go to a printing place, T-shirt printing place, and just get a T-shirt with one, like just have that symbol printed on it or whatever. But I mean, this is an interesting thing. Like, it's a chance to make that Danish story come true. Why don't we why don't we all mark ourselves with that mark that, that the Muslims are putting on Christian homes, where they're marking those families for genocide? They're marking the women, the young ones, or the, you know, the attractive ones, for sexual slavery, and marking the adult men for death, and the children for probably for Janissaries. So anyway, it's something small that people can do, and you know, more and more people are recognizing it. And when people ask, "What is that?" and you can tell them, you can explain what this is, and people go, "Oh, they're taking the symbol back. Oh, I get it. That's cool." Like, it's a good thing. It's a small, simple thing you can do that's not going to get you arrested or fired, because it's very difficult for someone to come up with a reason why there's something wrong with that. They can't call you Islamophobic. You're standing with the victims of a contemporary and very real genocide. So I recognize most people are too frightened or too indifferent or too ignorant for the vast majority of strategies that I would like to see happen in terms of defending classical liberalism and libertarianism and Western values from this. But this is something we can do.
No, you know, you're exactly right. I think there are some cracks, you know, just some commentary and just sort of, you know, talking about some of the thoughts that float through my head occasionally. You're looking at in reference to the buttons that you're talking about, and identifying or making that sort of a clear mark of identification and separation of us from them. That's easily done. It's just simply a matter of getting out there. I think there are some cracks in the system with respect to what's happening in the Middle East, and I think that is creating some, I don't know if it's the discontent is wrong, or certainly some concern in the Muslim community with respect to what's happening in the Middle East and the echoes and the reverberations that are playing out here in Canada. I think people are slowly waking up. What we're dealing with mostly is we're dealing with a lack of organization and a lack of sort of a proliferation of information relating to Islam and what Islam and Muslims are really all about. Once we get that off the ground, that's sort of what I'm working on in part here in Western Canada. We've seen two visits. By a notable speaker, Dr. Warner, to Canada. That's never happened before. There are cracks in the system. Things are very slowly starting to change. And just from a commentary point of view, and going back to sort of a the good Muslim argument. Isn't it funny that we have seen what we have seen throughout, and we touched on this briefly with Obama and his sort of very public praise of the Oklahoma mosque. But what we're seeing in Canada and with in response to what's happening with ISIS is we haven't seen one demonstration, one march down the streets. You take a look at, like, for example, take a look at Sir Harwoodie in Calgary. Here you've got this television program, and it's not in the clip that I sent you, but it was in the one that I watched on Global. I haven't been able to find it. I think it was just a matter of editing. But here he is standing in front of his congregation, and there's probably, I don't know, maybe 150 or whatever it is guys in there at best. Well, how hard would it have been for Sir Harwoodie to get these 150 guys to simply all gather together with signs and walk very quietly down the streets, talking to people, saying, "That's not what we stand for. That's what we will never stand for."
Well, it would be impossible. It would be impossible because it is what they stand for.
But I know, but you see him in a church lying through his teeth to a bunch of people who are asking questions, the answers to which are self-evident. I mean, it's just, it boggles the mind.
Yeah, I mean, he's really just trying to jockey for position as an influence peddler. You know, Don, I take this opportunity to thank you for calling in tonight and for tremendous thoughts and really great addition to this. I'm counting on you now. So we're already at an hour and 10 minutes.
We are, too.
Yeah, we're 10 minutes past the hour. Can you call in again next week at 8:30 Eastern time?
I sure can. Yeah, I'd love to. I'd be happy to. Yeah, it'd be an honor. Thank you very much.
That would be. I'd really appreciate it if you did. And hopefully tonight, I know it's going to be, for you, it will be obscenely early. No, it'll be later, I think. There'll be a full, this what they call a blood moon. There's going to be a full eclipse of below on the rock.
Yeah, that's the, are you still there? Oh, hello? Hello?
Oh, did we lose Vlad, rather?
No, I think we lost Vlad.
Yeah, it looks like we did. We lost Vlad. So what I'll do is I'll close out the program. And Don, you are a wealth of information. Please do call back next week and join Vlad on his program, Islamic Issues with Vlad Tepes. Don, have a wonderful, wonderful evening. And just to let you know, I lived in Calgary for 5 years, close to 30 years ago, and I just loved living in Calgary. I lived in South Calgary. I lived in North Calgary. It was just beautiful. And I don't like what I see happening to that beautiful city today.
No, absolutely not. You've hit the nail on the head with respect to what's happening there. But, I mean, that's a reflection of, now it's even more overt with the Muslim mayor of Calgary, Naheed Nenshi, and some of the things you see going on, sort of the jihadi farm teams that are springing up in that city, and certainly the one to the north in Edmonton. But, yeah, no, thank you. Listen, thank you very much. I appreciate that. And I know Vlad probably dropped off the map there, but I got the last bit of what he was saying about the blood moon. There's going to be one out. I think it's out here. It's going to be about 3:30. So I'm going to be probably heading out to the mountains there and get a high spot and watch it as it comes up there. So I'm definitely in touch
very
with that.
Very nice. Get some photos.
All right, well, listen, thank you very much and have yourself a good evening.
You bet. Thank you very much, Don. We'll be speaking next week.
You bet. Good night.
And good night. And ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for tuning in to Islamic Issues with your host, Vlad Tepes. We will join you back here next Tuesday, 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time. Everybody, have a wonderful evening. And Islam de lenta est. Good night, everyone.